Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, nearly a year after 12-year-old Tamir Rice was killed by a Cleveland police officer, the county prosecutor is giving signs that he won't be strenuously encouraging indictments, deflating the hopes of many that the officer, Timothy Lohman, will face any punishment at all for the killing. Whether or not you are surprised by this may have to do with your experiences with law enforcement in your community or with your knowledge of the workings of the legal system when it comes to police shootings. If the justice system won't bring justice, what could? We'll discuss those issues with civil rights attorney Chase Madar. He's the author of the book The Passion of Chelsea Manning and of an article for The Nation titled Why It's Impossible to Indict a Cop. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. Palestinians kill three Israelis as violence mounts in day of rage, was the headline over a Washington Post story October 13th. The story began, quote, three Israelis were killed and nearly two dozen injured in a series of Palestinian attacks Tuesday, sparking calls by Israeli officials to cordon off Arab neighborhoods in Jerusalem and a decision by the security cabinet to place soldiers in city centers to support the police, close quote. The next graph noted, quote, almost 2 weeks of daily violence, including a spate of attacks by knife-wielding Palestinian teenagers, has left Israelis deeply shaken and fearful of another sustained Palestinian uprising, close quote, and that as many as 22 Israelis were reported wounded. This was followed by a quote from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu promising vengeance. Quote, Israel will settle the score with the murderers and those who help them. We will cut the hands of whoever tries to hurt us, close quote. Only several paragraphs in does the story give any indication that the violence has been anything other than one way. Quote, eight Israelis have been slain and dozens have been wounded in the last couple of weeks, while at least 28 Palestinians have been killed by Israelis. According to Israeli authorities, a dozen of the slain Palestinians were attackers. The rest died in clashes with Israeli forces, close quote. So here, the heretofore unmentioned Palestinian dead come in at the back end of a sentence about Israeli fatalities, to whose numbers are added dozens of wounded, so it's not immediately clear that there are 3.5 times as many dead on one side as the other. Then comes a sort of suggestion that you oughtn't care too much about the Palestinian dead. A dozen of them, according to Israeli authorities, were attackers, while the rest, you have to do the math yourself to figure out that these amount to twice as many as the Israeli dead, died in clashes with the Israeli forces. The word clashes, of course, connotes a power symmetry. When the Israeli military, thanks in part to U.S. aid, is one of the best armed in the world. Palestinians whom they clash with are typically unarmed or equipped with homemade weapons. Netanyahu's vow to settle the score suggests a view of human life as something that can be tallied up, with deaths on one side balancing deaths on the other. If media outlets are going to present that as a legitimate perspective, they might as well acknowledge the actual score in this horrific violence. Since 2009, according to the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, Palestinians have killed 43 Israeli civilians and 12 members of Israeli security forces. Israeli security forces have killed 636 Palestinians, with Israeli civilians killing another 14. This doesn't include the military assault on the Gaza Strip in July of 2014, during which an estimated 1,767 Palestinians died, along with 64 Israeli soldiers and 2 Israeli civilians. In his October 16th column, The Washington Post's George Will took a swipe at Bernie Sanders and anyone concerned about economic inequality, offering this nostrum. Quote, the fundamental producer of income inequality is freedom. Individuals have different aptitudes and attitudes. Not even universal free public education, even were it well done, could equalize the ability of individuals to add value to the economy. Close quote. Economist Dean Baker noted some of what's entailed in accepting that idea. You have to believe Bill Gates is rich as Croesus because of his aptitude and attitude. The government's willingness to arrest anyone who infringes on the patent and copyright monopolies it gave him has nothing to do with it. Nor does too-big-to-fail insurance have anything to do with Wall Street wealth. Tax scams play no role, nor Federal Reserve Board policies that deliberately slow the economy and reduce the rate of job creation anytime workers look like increasing their bargaining power. Trade policies that pit U.S. manufacturing workers against low-paid workers in other countries, but protect doctors, lawyers, and other professionals? Not a thing. It's just freedom. Will went on to complain about how Black and Latina women have too many children out of wedlock, thus failing to pass on the, quote, habits, mores, customs, and dispositions necessary for seizing opportunities, close quote. And he ends by suggesting that concerns about inequality are really just envy. Alongside the moralizing, Will is trying to say something about how government can't fight inequality. Baker's point is that the government is part of the economy. The battle is over who is likely to be better served by its actions. And finally, Fox News reported October 14th that Cuba has sent General Leopoldo Cintra Frias and hundreds of troops to Syria to assist the Russian and Assad governments in operating Russian tanks. 2 days later, as Adam Johnson reported for Fair.org, the Daily Beast leapt on the story. Under the headline, "Cuba is intervening in Syria to help Russia. It's not the first time Havana's assisted Moscow." Daily Beast reporter James Bloodworth wrote, quote, "Russia, Iran, and Cuba, three regimes Obama has sought to bring in from the cold, are now helping to prop up the regime of Bashar al-Assad, ruler of a fourth regime he also tried in vain to court early on in his presidency. Obama has been holding his hand out in a gesture of goodwill to America's adversaries, only for them to blow him a raspberry back in his face while standing atop a pile of Syrian corpses," close quote. The piece was illustrated with a photo of Fidel Castro, who is not president of Cuba, with Nikita Khrushchev, who's been dead for 44 years. The story was then widely circulated on social media because it would be a big story, undermining the easing of tensions between Cuba and the U.S., on which Barack Obama has spent a fair amount of political capital. But there's a problem that you can probably guess. The story looks, in Johnson's words, increasingly bunk. The Cuban and American governments have categorically denied a Cuban troop presence in Syria. No one else has been able to confirm it. Washington Post correspondent Nick Miroff told Johnson, "Unless we see some evidence or someone credible saying it on the record, it looks like a zero." Nevertheless, there was presidential candidate Ted Cruz echoing the claim to millions on Meet the Press to an uncritical Chuck Todd. Quote, "There are a couple hundred Cubans right now with a major Cuban general fighting in the Syrian civil war. You've got Iran. You've got General Suleiman in bed with the Russians. So you now got Russia, Cuba, and Iran all arm in arm," close quote. Fox News and the Daily Beast should correct their stories to acknowledge that there is no evidence of a meaningful Cuban presence in Syria. As the crisis in that country grows, unsubstantiated claims like these do nothing but ratchet up tensions and make an already volatile situation worse. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. When the Cuyahoga County prosecutor released two reports asserting that Cleveland police officers acted reasonably in shooting a 12-year-old boy holding an air pistol within seconds of arriving on the scene, it was seen by many as preparing the public for the fact that the prosecutor would not be strenuously pursuing indictment of the officers before the grand jury. And for many, that's depressing but not terribly surprising. There are some who believe law enforcement don't make mistakes, or any mistakes they make should be overlooked because they have a hard job. Those that don't share that view look to the legal system to bring justice when police officers fail. But every day brings evidence that that faith is misplaced, that the mechanisms that in theory should serve as checks on police power either exist in theory more than in practice or don't exist at all. How can those outraged by police violence turn anger into change? Here to discuss the issue is Chase Madar. He's a civil rights attorney and the author of the book, The Passion of Chelsea Manning. Welcome to Counterspin, Chase Madar.
Great to be talking with you.
Well, the fatal shooting of Tamir Rice by Officer Timothy Lohman was heartbreaking. It didn't come out of the blue, though. The Cleveland Police Department has already been cited by the Justice Department for excessive force, for which officers are rarely disciplined. A 2013 investigation by the state attorney general found systemic failure. That was their term, systemic failure in the department. There's just a lot of wrong in this story, from the failure to vet Lohman, who had a terrible record, to the harassment of Rice's family. It's staggering. But now all the attention is on the prosecutor and the grand jury, as if some measure of justice will come from that process. But the law on police shootings just doesn't work the way that people might imagine it does it?
No, it doesn't. And it's important to face that head on from the very beginning. I think there's a very hardwired tendency among Americans in general, and liberals in particular, to think that even when things are going wrong, that the law is good and fundamentally on our side, that the law is synonymous with justice. And people like to think this, whether it's regarding the dysfunction of our financial system, that it must be the result of crime rather than the ordinary workings of our financial laws. People think that anything that goes wrong in wartime must be a crime, even though the laws of war are incredibly permissive and really have the function of licensing acts of lethal violence more than restraining it. And this goes double, triple, quadruple for police violence. In fact, the laws as they actually exist in the United States, not as we wish they might be, but as they actually exist, are incredibly deferential to police officers using lethal violence. And this is not just a matter of local aberrations in places like Ferguson, Missouri, or Staten Island. The laws really shielding police violence from accountability, that goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. And it's a part of, you know, Supreme Court jurisprudence that police can really fire with a great degree of latitude.
Well, what is that legal underpinning? There's something called objective reasonableness that seems to get to the heart of the actual standard in play when police kill somebody.
In the 1985 landmark U.S. Supreme Court case of Tennessee versus Garner, the court set up an objectively reasonable standard for whether or not a police officer can use lethal force. And of course, this sounds wonderful. I mean, what could be better? Objectively reasonable standard? You've got to be objective. That's good. And reasonable, who could be against that? But the way this is worked out in actual practice in courts, and including the Supreme Court and subsequent decisions about police violence, is that it is incredibly deferential to police officers. It's really what seemed objectively reasonable to the police officer at that moment, without any second guessing being allowed, without any hindsight being allowed. And it's more of a subjectively reasonable test. Now, there are limits. I don't want to say that absolutely anything goes. And some listeners will remember the case of Abner Louima in New York City, a man who was taken by the police. He'd gotten in a scuffle outside a nightclub, I believe, and he was sexually tortured by New York police with a plunger handle in the bathroom of a police precinct. And, you know, the law was very clear that what the police did there was wrong, and they were punished by federal prosecution very swiftly. And even the most diehard defenders of the police will not say that's okay. But if there's any conceivable way to justify what a police officer has done, it's probably going to hold up in court. And those of us who know the law were therefore not so surprised by the no bill of indictment handed down for the police shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, or by the police strangulation of Eric Garner in Staten Island, which also came up with a no bill of indictment in the grand jury. And what I mean by that is these cases were not even brought to trial. They were deemed by the grand jury to be not trial worthy, not strong enough. Looking at the other mechanisms where you think might be able to restrain police violence or to control and regulate the police use of violence, they usually come up empty-handed too. You might think that suing a police department would, okay, it doesn't result in a criminal conviction or a prison sentence for police officers, but shouldn't that install good behavior or better behavior? Shouldn't that incentivize good behavior? Surely the financial hit of a big multimillion-dollar payout will set up a new incentive structure and will deter bad behavior in the future. It makes common sense, but it turns out to be all wrong. In fact, the payouts that police departments routinely give out, especially in big cities, that money does not come from police department budgets at all. It comes from usually a general city budget. The individual police officer at fault doesn't have to pay any money himself or herself. And in New York City, even if there's a successful suit against a police officer, I was told by Ron Kuby, a veteran civil rights litigator who sues the police routinely, that the report of this lawsuit won't even be put in a police officer's permanent record or in his or her file.
Ultimately, the taxpayer is paying for...
Yes. Ultimately, it's the taxpayer. I mean, that's the cruel irony of this.
I think people want police who kill people who pose no threat to them to go to jail, just like criminal bankers, not because they think jail fixes everything. I think it's the double standard that galls, you know, the one law for me, another for thee. We have people doing life without parole for marijuana offenses. But if we want institutional change, how far would even criminal prosecutions go toward achieving that?
They should be used, and they should even result in conviction sometimes. But if we want real institutional change, then I think we're going to have a different focus and a broader focus than that, because criminal prosecutions, using that as the spear tip, really doesn't seem to work to reform police departments, to change police behavior. And I think when it comes to reforming police departments and police behavior, it's either go big and look at the really big picture, or just, you know, that's just the only way, or nothing.
Well, let's go bigger. I mean, when they take up these questions, corporate media evinces what I would call a polite dismay. You know, gosh, they sure wish this would stop happening somehow, you know. But the responses never step outside the system. And of course, they privilege the police perspective in the day to day. It's completely legitimate for a story to contain only comments from law enforcement. They just aren't seen as interested actors, you know, as non-neutral. Yeah. It's almost like the state. They're benign by definition. But if we want to think bigger, well, first of all, you have to give a damn. You know, you have to see a problem. You wrote in The Nation last year that the fact that the federal government doesn't keep a strict national tally of police homicides shows just how seriously it takes this problem. The Guardian has just reported that the FBI data that they obtained doesn't include Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, John Crawford. You know, Florida hasn't submitted any data on police-related deaths in 10 years. And the FBI data doesn't even note whether the victims were armed, you know. But but the FBI's James Comey keeps coming out saying he's really sorry about it, man.
Yeah.
Data collection seems like a place to at least start.
Yeah, it certainly does. But I'm sad to say that almost a year after I published this long article in The Nation called Why It's Impossible to Indict a Cop, it is still the case that there's no good national record keeping. You know, I went to a talk last night and another journalist was saying that he was talking to people in Washington and, you know, they're still dependent on following the Guardian newspaper and the sports website Deadspin, which are doing a better job. And our government, even for all its resources, is dependent on the sports website Deadspin and a British newspaper, The Guardian, for their statistics, which is quite pathetic.
Well, what would it look like?
What would meaningful police reform look like? Many of the reforms that are getting tossed about right now are very, you know, small-scale reforms. newer and better training. Body cameras is a big one. More women who might be less confrontational, more reasonable on the police force than men. You know, I don't want to dismiss these out of hand. I don't think they're necessarily useless. There might be some good things. There might be some real liabilities to some of these reforms, too, especially with body cameras, which has a certain dystopian potential and very often is much better at shielding the police from liability than actually bringing newer responsibility to them. But bigger reforms and bigger thinking about reforms are needed. One example of this is from recent headlines here in New York, where the police department and the mayor have announced that police are going to be rousting homeless people who are sleeping or just kind of, you know, aimlessly riding the New York City subway system. This is what the city's resources are going to be directed towards. Social policy about homelessness that's heavy on the police. And we need to think about what's the opportunity cost here. Why can't that money be spent, instead of on police and a police solution, on making homeless shelters more habitable? And that's just one example. It seems that so often social policy in the United States has to involve law enforcement and armed law enforcement, and everything becomes a police matter, every social problem. And it's important to recognize that a great many social problems are best not handled by the police. And I mean drug addiction here. I was just in Portugal where I did interview some people who work in government there. Portugal has decriminalized drugs to a very high degree. They have not legalized them like in, you know, Colorado or Washington, but they have decriminalized them, meaning that all drug consumption issues and drug use issues are handled by the Department of Public Health, not by the police. And they've had very good results. And now that policy, after 10 years, enjoys very broad and deep multi-partisan support. Even the right-wing parties are all behind it because it's been so successful. And we need to think about that here, you know, not just for marijuana, but also for heroin, for meth, and for crack use. And that's one way where we can strongly improve our police departments is by ending the war on drugs in a reasonable and sane way. I just wrote something for Al Jazeera that I think it might alienate some of my left-to-center friends, but about business crimes and how we need to recognize that not everything on Wall Street that we hate is actually criminal. And I think that more than 90% of what led to the most recent Wall Street crash back in 2008 was actually perfectly legal. And it really lets the whole systemic issues off the hook if we pretend that it's just a few criminal bad apples there. I think we need major financial system reform and regulatory reform, but we should recognize that the priority should be restructuring the financial markets through civil law and administrative law rather than having a show trial prosecution every couple of months that makes people feel good but leaves the overall system in place.
Absolutely. And that's kind of what we're getting at here is the idea that we really want things to fundamentally change. And on that note, when I hear that left and right agree on criminal justice reforms, I tend to worry. At the same time, I think it's a luxury to allow the perfect to be the enemy of the good. So,
sure.
You know, people are talking about mass incarceration. They're talking about sentencing disparities. I don't really feel that they thought, wow, we've done a lot of harmful and stupid and misdirected things, you know, but I do see that there's some kind of political zeitgeist happening to at least put these things on the table. But how radical in terms of going to the root do you feel that it is? You know, what do you read as the hopefulness quotient of the current interest at all levels in at least talking about criminal justice reform?
Well, I think it's a good thing. Yesterday, there was a big story in the New York Times about how police chiefs and district attorneys from all over the country, representing many very big cities and jurisdictions, not everybody, a lot of them, are getting together. They formed a new group. I can't remember what it's called, that is admitting that mass incarceration is a huge problem in the U.S. It's gone too far. We need to find other solutions. Now, I rolled my eyes a bit at this, and other people I know and respect who have worked in this area a lot longer than I have did too. But the only thing worse than having these police chiefs spout, you know, some rhetoric that, you know, is sort of on your side, but you're not, you're skeptical of them, is to have them against you. And I think that it's a good thing, or it's an indicator of the political mood, that they're at least whistling a different tune. I think getting real practical reforms is going to be something else. And it's important to be both radical and practical. And that means being skeptical of big reform packages that are getting advertised as wonderful, bipartisan, and, you know, super nice. The sentencing reform that's moving forward in the Senate is an example of this. You have this utterly retrograde senator from Iowa, 82-year-old Chuck Grassley, who is almost single-handedly restraining good, meaningful sentencing reform. And there are plenty of Democratic laggards there. So there was a package of sentencing reforms that were put together in a single bill. It's very mild. It doesn't do a whole lot. It's better than nothing, I suppose. But given how hard it is to get a single bill passed, I just hope it doesn't suck all the air out of further efforts to do real reform at the federal level.
So maybe we use it as a chance to push for the harder, the more serious reforms, the more overarching reforms that we would like to see.
Yeah, yeah.
We've been speaking with Chase Madar. His book is The Passion of Chelsea Manning. Chase Madar, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Wonderful to chat with you, Jeanine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Jeanine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.